This is the Downey's Journal on Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. Earlier this month, a global engineering company based out of Wilmington received a $99 million loan guarantee from the U.S. Department of Agriculture for the construction of a biofuels facility. If built, it wouldn't be completed for another 2 years. But when it does, it will be the first biofuels facility in the country to harvest non-edible crops on a commercial scale. Stephen O'Connell has more.
The Chemtex biofuels plant will be built in Clinton in Sampson County. It comes with the support from the 2008 Energy Bill, the North Carolina Strategic Plan for Biofuels Leadership, and several state and private entities, including the Biofuel Center of North Carolina, the Farm Bureau Agency, and the Department of Agriculture. Communications Director at the Biofuel Center of North Carolina, Will Glenn, says the center was created in response to the Biofuel Leadership Plan as a place for research and information for people interested in growing, manufacturing, and using biofuels in North Carolina.
We have a long-term task of developing a large-scale biofuels industry, and our goal is to reduce the state's dependence on imported petroleum. We're state-supported, and we've put together North Carolina Strategic Plan for Biofuels Leadership that sets the goal of replacing 10% of the petroleum imported into the state with biofuels locally grown and produced.
Another force behind the state's efforts in the biofuel industry is the Biomass Crop Assistance Program. Biomass is material that can be found or grown to harvest biofuels, such as ethanol or biodiesel. It includes wood chips, sugarcane, corn, canola, and high-energy grasses like switchgrass, arundodonax, or giant miscanthus. To encourage farmers, the Crop Assistance Program helps with startup costs for growing the biomass crops. Glenn says the industry could bring a lot of revenue to the state.
This could be a great boom. It could change the landscape of North Carolina and North Carolina's farmers, especially in eastern North Carolina. We expect new energy crops to be grown here in the next 5 to 10 years, and a lot of jobs being created, a lot of plants being here, just a lot of new opportunity for the biofuels industry, for North Carolina farmers and those who like to grow plants that can be used as biofuels.
When the Biofuel Center was established, it had the mandate to produce fuel with non-edible crops, such as cotton and high-energy grasses. With issues of drought and the food versus fuel debate, corn has become an increasingly unattractive crop for the production of fuels, such as ethanol. Associate Professor in the Department of Biological and Agricultural Engineering, Dr. Ratna Sharma Shivappa, has been working in the field of bioengineering for over 9 years. She says researchers are able to convert crops such as high-energy grasses into fuel using a three-step process.
What we have found is that they have this component called lignin, which we really need to break down somehow to release the carbohydrates, which are needed to make sugars and finally a fuel or any kind of high-value product.
Dr. Sharma Shivappa says their biggest obstacle now is to make the process of converting these crops into fuel as cost-effective and efficient as possible. She says the state offers a unique advantage.
North Carolina has different environments, we have the coast, you know, the Piedmont, and we have the mountains. So we could essentially be growing grasses that are more adapted to these three different types of geographic locations and increase the biomass that we get.
Dr. Sharma says they are not quite to the point of producing these fuels on a commercial scale, but thinks the technology could be realized in the next 5 to 10 years. Earlier this summer, Chemtex started its search for farmers interested in growing high-energy grasses like switchgrass or giant miscanthus. Farm owner Houston Warren has signed up to grow the giant miscanthus blend in Newport in Carteret County. Houston says he's working with Reprieve Renewables, the Farm Bureau Agency, and Chemtex to grow the grasses. Under the Crop Assistance Program, the Farm Bureau will provide him with establishment costs for 5 years. Reprieve will supply him with the seed for giant miscanthus for $1,000 an acre. The Farm Bureau will contribute $750. Warren will pay $250.
Reprieve will get the grass established, and then they turn it over to Chemtex. And Chemtex employs an agronomist who then comes out and makes sure that the grass is government to their standards.
Warren, who's dedicated 40 acres of his land to the grass, says it takes 2 to 3 years to fully mature and can be productive for 15.
They will come in and establish or plant the grass in March, and they will harvest approximately one ton from it in September, and then it goes up to the possibility of up to 20 tons plus once it becomes established and is mature.
Warren attended meetings hosted by the North Carolina Cooperative Extension. Cooperative Extension agent for Sampson County, Sandy Stewart, has been speaking with farmers about signing up with Chemtex. He says the land in North Carolina could be a good environment for the grasses.
I think it's a good fit here because we do have quite a bit of these deep, sandier soils located here in Sampson County and surrounding counties that I think would certainly have the potential to be favorable for growing these particular crops.
The meetings that took place this past summer encouraged the use of marginal land for biocrops. Marginal land has low production value and is typically non-arable. Although marginal land was the focus at the cooperative agency's meetings, Houston Warren is growing the miscanthus on Class 1 soil, a soil predominant in eastern North Carolina, also called Norfolk Sandy Lawn. Warren thinks many farmers are skeptical of the facility because the technology is new and because of recent failures at corn-based ethanol plants in the country. However, biofuels may be the future of North Carolina agriculture. Research is strong at schools such as NC State and Central Carolina Community College. The agriculture industry is the state's largest source of revenue, and the U.S. Navy has been using biofuel in recent years. The Chemtex plant in Clinton is one step toward making North Carolina a leader in the biofuels industry. Stephen O'Connell, Public Radio East.
This is the Downeast Journal. A potent visual demonstration may have been the lift needed to get the tobacco-free parks policy in place in Carteret County. George Olson has more.
More and more venues, whether indoors or out, have been going tobacco-free in recent years, so perhaps there was an inevitability that Carteret County Parks would one day go that route.
There had been some movement from other counties and other municipalities across the state as far as tobacco-free policies and ordinances, and so this was something that was kind of moving eastward.
Andrea Swain, the health educator at the Carteret County Health Department. However, making the parks tobacco-free still required going to the County Board of Commissioners and making the request in a manner strong enough to garner votes. So the health department brought in a student group from Croatan High School, Students Against Destructive Decisions, or SAD, to help them make the case.
All the kids thought it was a really great idea because parks promote health and they promote being able to go outside and play, and you don't want your kids going out to a playground and trying to like get exercise and then being surrounded by cigarette smoke. So it just kind of makes sense that we would make parks tobacco-free.
Kaylin Perry is a senior at Croatan High School and a member of SAD. It made sense, but how do you get across the prevalence of smoking at county parks without taking county commissioners on a day-long field trip to see what happens, bring a part of the park to the commissioners?
It was in early May, and there was probably a group of about 20 kids that showed up at Western Park, which is one of our county parks. And in 45 minutes, we collected 1,571 cigarette butts. So that was really shocking for me, at least, because I did not expect to collect 1,500 materials of trash, let alone just cigarette butts.
Which Kaylin Perry and two more SAD representatives presented during a May County Commissioners meeting, albeit in closed Ziploc bags. It made a quick impression, Andrea Swain.
They were surprised that many had come from just one park in just 45 minutes.
Though not enough of an impression that the board passed the policy immediately. There were questions about enforcement, though what SAD and the health department were requesting was not an ordinance that would involve police, but a policy which Swain describes as more of an awareness campaign and not turning anyone into the tobacco police. Kaylin Perry with SAD concurred.
That's not really what it's about. It's not about catching people. It's mainly about getting people to be aware that a park is to promote health and it's not for people to be, you know, smoking. And also it's just like we knew that it would be easier, I guess, instead of being law enforcement involved, it would just be better to have a policy because that way people don't feel like, oh, they're coming after us, they're trying to get us in trouble, because we're not. We just want people to be healthy and to respect the fact that kids don't need to be subjected to cigarette smoke.
At the May meeting, unlike with a cigarette, the SAD members did not experience instant gratification. That took a little time before Kaylin Perry and her fellow SAD members saw the fruits of their stinky labor.
And it was disappointing at first, but then we just realized that we could regroup and present it to them again a month later in June, and then we ended up getting the policy passed. So definitely it taught me to be persistent and to persevere and to, you know, not give up.
The tobacco-free parks policy that Kaylin Perry and SAD and the Carteret County Health Department promoted went into effect September 1st. Signage to that effect should be up soon at the county's 14 parks. I'm George Olson.
The Down East Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with Martha O'Hara, DDS, practicing general dentistry for all ages. Saturday appointments available in Jacksonville at 922 Henderson Drive. Dr. Martha O'Hara, 910-346-1133. According to the 2012 Trafficking in Persons report released in June, there are an estimated 27 million slaves around the world. On Tuesday, President Barack Obama spoke in New York City at the Clinton Global Initiative on the topic of human trafficking.
I do not use that word slavery lightly. It evokes, obviously, one of the most painful chapters in our nation's history.
The speech comes on the heels of the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation.
Our fight against human trafficking is one of the great human rights causes of our time, and the United States will continue to lead it in partnership with you. The change we seek will not come easy, but we can draw strength from the movements of the past.
Modern-day slavery is defined by the United Nations as the recruitment, transport, transfer, harboring, or receipt of a person by such means as threats or use of force or other forms of coercion, of abduction, or fraud, or deception for the purpose of exploitation. Human trafficking takes on many different forms, from men being forced to work on fishing boats and in fields, to women being locked in sweatshops, to young boys being forced to become soldiers, and little girls repeatedly being used for sex acts.
It is barbaric, and it is evil, and it has no place in a civilized world.
The president announced an executive order that would strengthen protections against trafficking in persons and federal contracts.
It's specific about the prohibitions. It does more to protect workers. It ensures stronger compliance. In short, we're making clear that American tax dollars must never, ever be used to support the trafficking of human beings. We will have zero tolerance. We mean what we say. We will enforce it.
President Obama said in his speech that modern anti-trafficking laws must be passed and enforced, justice systems must be strengthened, and victims must be cared for. He is also calling on Congress to renew the Trafficking Victims Protection Act. A common misconception is that modern-day slavery takes place exclusively in large cities or overseas. It also happens here. Numbers released early in 2012 ranked North Carolina 7th in the nation in human trafficking. L.C. Morris takes us into a world where the trading of human life for sex or labor could be happening closer to home.
Human trafficking in the United States has become a serious social problem in many parts of the country. Today, you'll hear the story of Anne, as read by Jacqueline Morris. Anne was a victim of child human trafficking. She was recruited at the age of 11 by someone she thought was a friend into the sex trade right under her mother's nose. This form of modern-day slavery allowed Anne to go home every night after the exploitation would occur and then on to school. The routine would continue for years.
I was just a normal 11-year-old girl. I was shy and had a hard time making friends at school. But one day a girl that seemed really nice came up to me and asked me to eat lunch with her in the cafeteria. Every day after that, she sat with me and seemed interested in me. It felt good to finally have someone that was my friend. One day, while we were at her home, she said, "Let's go over to my uncle's house, and he will get us some ice cream and probably take us to buy some clothes." He was really nice, and he took us in his new van to get some ice cream. Then he said that we could pick out 3 outfits, and he took us shopping. The clothes that he wanted us to get were much more sexier than I had ever worn.
More than 2,500 incidents of human trafficking were investigated between January 2008 and June 2010, according to the Justice Department's Bureau of Justice. 48% involved adult prostitution, 40% involved the prostitution or sexual exploitation of a child.
Here in North Carolina, the two most common entities of human trafficking are sex trafficking and labor trafficking.
Detective Chauncey Congleton, Pitt County Sheriff's Department. He heads up the Human Trafficking Task Force.
You'll find that most of all your human trafficking victims, whether it be sexual or labor trafficking, that the victim is always going to live where they work.
Human trafficking is the illegal trade in human beings for the purposes of reproductive slavery, commercial sexual exploitation, forced labor, or a modern-day form of slavery.
Human trafficking is not your cut-and-dry case. It's not like an armed robbery or a break-in that you would work as a law enforcement officer. It's an organization. It's organized crime.
According to experts, North Carolina is a prime location for human trafficking because of major highways. For example, Interstates 85 and 95. Just last month, the U.S. Attorney's Office stated that trafficking has increased and cited I-77 and I-40 as well. Agriculture plays a big role.
Dealing with labor trafficking on farms, you will find that the trafficker will come up with makeshift grocery stores on the farmland. They would take a single wide trailer or an old ran-down shack on that land and make it a grocery store. They would charge the victim $5 for a pack of hot dogs or $20 for a six-pack of beer, $5 for a roll of toilet tissue. And they'll make sure that when payday comes, the victim gets no paycheck.
The most common forms of enslavement include labor, such as farming or working in a sweatshop, and the sex trade.
By the time I left Uncle's house, I had been raped 4 times and told to return the next night and on the weekends. He told me that if I told anyone, that he would kill my mom and my sister. And he said that if I tried to run away, that they could find me anywhere. I went home and I did not tell my mom. I went straight to bed. The next morning, I got up and I went to school. I was so hurt by this girl. And as it turns out, she was a recruiter who had just got girls to come to Uncle's house, who was not really her uncle, but a trafficker of children into sex slavery. For the next years, this was my life, being raped every night and going to school during the day.
Human traffickers target those who are society's most vulnerable. Victims include immigrants and children, children who are loners or runaways.
The average age of entry into prostitution in the United States is 12 to 14 years old.
Charity Magnuson, director of NC Stop Human Trafficking.
A grown man will go to wherever there is a 13-year-old girl, so schools or malls or parks, and go up to a group of 3 or 4 girls and give them all a compliment. And the girl who doesn't know how to take the compliment because she has low self-esteem, that's the girl that he'll target. And he'll work on her for anywhere from 6 hours to 6 months until he can convince her that he loves her and that he's her boyfriend and he's going to take care of her.
She says pimped-controlled prostitution is the norm.
Then eventually he starts to manipulate her, and usually drugs are introduced, and tells her that you need to do this for me because all of these things I've done for you before.
The United States is the second highest rated destination for sex trade, and North Carolina is one of the states with the highest population of human trafficking, ranking 8th out of the top 10 states in 2010 and 7th in 2011.
Domestic sex trafficking, which deals with our people right here in America, you know, underage girls on the street prostituting because their mom and dad owe a drug debt to a drug dealer. They pawn off their children, their 15, 16-year-old daughters, to these drug dealers, so they put them on the street to make money to pay off their drug debt.
The federal government and the state of North Carolina has been targeting this crime for several years. One cannot discount the fear that victims live under. They usually have been physically and sexually assaulted, and the emotion battering involved in psychological control is constant. Again, we hear from Anne.
I was told not to look the men in the eyes that raped me, and told that I could not look the trafficker in the eye either. He said that he owned me, and that I had to do whatever he told me to. Sometimes they beat me, and made sure that it could not be seen outside of my clothing so that my mom wouldn't know. My life was filled with terror. I stayed that way for years. Finally, when I was 16, now filled with so much anger and resentment towards my mom, the law enforcement people rescued me.
Based upon cases where race was known, the Justice Department documented sex trafficking victims were more likely to be black at 40% or white at 26%. compared to labor trafficking victims who were more likely to be Hispanic at 63% or Asian at 17%.
These girls are shipped out every week. They'll come in on Sunday night or early Monday morning, and then they'll stay there and prostitute for the remainder of that week, and they'll get shipped out late Sunday or early Monday, then a new shipment of girls will come in.
An estimated 100,000 youths are prostituted every year in the United States. Lowell and Sally Sinintz are the founders of Wings of Shelter International.
They're being utilized from anywhere from 10 to 20 times a night. The child is extremely traumatized. Once a law enforcement investigator rescues this child out of this plight, they're brought to our safe house. At that point, they're pretty frightened, they're pretty brainwashed, and they're very, very untrusted. They don't know anyone in their lives at that point that they can truly trust.
Based in Florida, Sally says Wings of Shelter may be the only safe house for youths in their state who were once prostitutes.
We find that child has extreme post-traumatic stress disorders. They have nightmares. They have a brainwashing that the sophisticated traffickers have used on them, where they're trained not to look directly into the eyes. They have such a low self-esteem and such a sense of terror inside of them.
Numbers show most confirmed suspects were 81% male, more than half at 62% were black, while labor trafficking suspects were more likely to be Hispanic at 48%.
It's just like a circuit. These girls may come from Puerto Rico, Russia, Mexico, Venezuela, and a lot of the times by way of New York or Atlanta, Georgia. And they are shipping in and throughout every brothel in Georgia, come on down I-85, start working them in brothels in South Carolina, on into Charlotte, on into Durham, Raleigh, on up to my town, Greenville, all the eastern North Carolina towns and cities, and they'll rotate them out.
83% of victims in confirmed sex trafficking cases were identified as U.S. citizens, while most confirmed labor trafficking victims were identified as undocumented aliens at 67% or qualified aliens at 28%.
Human trafficking is the fastest growing crime in the world, and I do predict that it will surpass illegal gun running by 2012. If not by 2012, before 2013 comes in.
Victims of modern-day slavery have many faces. They are men and women, adults and children. NC Stop Human Trafficking is a statewide organization whose mission is to eradicate modern-day slavery in all its forms. For more information, log on to ncstophumantrafficking.wordpress.com. Wings of Shelter International Incorporated is an organization dedicated to the intervention of human trafficking and child slavery. More information can be found at wingsofshelter.com. I'm L.C. Morris.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. I wanted to talk about water today. Water came to mind this week because, well, I forgot to water my vegetable garden. It had been such a wet, wet summer, but I had recently planted new fall vegetable seeds. And when plants are very, very young and have teeny tiny root systems, it's essential that there be plenty of water right up there at the top. Why every day? Well, think back to this week. It was really bright and sunny every day, which means the plants were breathing hard. Yeah, plants breathe, and so lots of water vapor was leaving the plant, being pulled up from the roots. And as soon as that root zone went dry, there was no water there. I lost half of my carrot plants and almost every one of my chard plants, all because I went 5 days without putting water out. If you're talking about little seedlings, 2 days is the most you probably should ever go without watering them. Once I saw that I had lost so many of the seedlings, I immediately watered the others and was reminded about the second important factor of water in the garden. Not only does it provide the turgor in the plant that helps the plant stand up, it also is the manner in which plants take up nutrients. As soon as I had watered the remaining baby seedlings, they almost doubled in size in the next 2 days, in part because they really needed that water, but also because the nutrients that plants need to be dissolved in soil water before the plant can absorb them. So, by making sure I had plenty of moisture around the roots of the plant, I was able to dissolve those nutrients that were there that the plants needed, and they were able to take them up and continue to grow. So, if you kind of forgot about watering your plants because it had been such a wet summer, and it doesn't have to be just vegetable plants. If you've put out mums for the fall, or any fall annuals, or if you put out any new young trees this year or shrubs, it's really time to go out and water now. We say about 1 good inch of water a week in a shrub area or on lawns. The same for most slow-growing plants. Those that are growing faster, those annual flowers and vegetables, look at them much more closely and make sure you keep them well watered. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.